With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Survivor 46 is here, and so is On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast, and we have a twist this season. The winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares, will be joining us every week.
We're going behind the scenes of the biggest moments, the how and the why things happen, and the strategy and analysis you can only get from someone like me, a Survivor winner.
Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
There was a group of friends from Pennsylvania that loved nature. They wanted to become better woodsmen.
I was laying on the couch with my wife, zooming in and out of all necks.
Anglers.
If you have a nice sized trout, they can give a fight, at least according to the book.
And outdoorsmen.
Basically the grocery store. Fresh groceries.
Stories turn into legends, and legends turn into traditions.
Very German.
This is the Backcountry PA Podcast.
Right off the bat, you guys want to introduce yourself, who you are, who you're with, and your roles with the company?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Jonathan Kalasinski. I'm the owner, inventor of Heated Hunts, and been running the company since 2016. We started off with an idea, and the idea turned into a garage product that was built, and then it worked, and I was astonished how well it worked. And the story is, from there, it turned into just like the American Dream story, starting a garage, and you know the company has grown significantly. So I'm the owner and I manage Heated Hunts, and that's my current role in the company. And we'll dive in more in a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, welcome, man.
Ed, thank you.
You want to be here. Tell us who you are and your background with the company and all that kind of stuff.
Yep. My name's Ed Swarner. I run the field staff and pro staff. I do all the shows, try to answer everybody's emails and messages if there's problems, you know, just try to take care of day-by-day business.
Yeah, I'm sure that's a hectic job with answering emails and phone calls and social media stuff. Yeah. And
we try to make sure we get a response to people right away.
How we start out the episodes, Patrick has a debate question that we're going to be doing before we get into talking about Heated Hunts, before we get into talking about how your season's going, all that kind of stuff. Patrick, you want to ask the debate question?
Yeah. So
let's do it.
So I'm going to go in reverse order. Now, if both of you agree on it, that's great. You can both agree on it. But I'm going to ask Ed first, what's one thing about the hunting industry, if you woke up tomorrow and you could change anything instantly, what's the one thing you would change?
Boy, that's a tough question. I don't know. There's just a lot of glorified stuff. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there that shouldn't be on the market.
What, like what kind of stuff?
Oh, I don't want to say specific companies, but
yeah. you can say a product, name a product. Or...
There's some questionable products that say that work that don't.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely the industry. Honestly, I agree with that. Like there is a lot of stuff out there that say, if you buy this, you're going to get big buck. If really the real products are the ones that you just put in the tool belt that help you, can assist you, and don't promise you, oh, you're going to get a big buck with this.
Right.
It's going to help you in the hunt.
And then you got like the people made in the USA. Our stuff's truly made in the US. How much other stuff's really, it's claimed to be made in the US, but it's not.
Yeah. Jonathan?
Same question.
Yeah.
I think the biggest is gimmicks and hating. So I see, like, Ed likes to shoot spike deer. No, I'm teasing him. But, you know, but like, any opportunity to harvest an animal is a trophy. Mm-hmm. And it's silly. I hate it when my friends call me, oh, I shot a buck. It's not the biggest one I ever shot. I'm like, what are you talking about? Mm-hmm. You shot a buck. Congratulations. You're right out there doing something that, like, statistics in PA, like, they sell what, like, they used to sell like a million tags a year, and only like 100,000 people got bucks. So, you know, that's like one out of three, one out of four people, give or take, right, get a buck. So to say you got a buck is phenomenal. To say you got a high trophy buck, oh my God, I got to jump off the ground. But it's not celebrated like it used to be. Like, that mentality when you were a kid and you get a buck, like, that should never die. Now I let a lot of deer walk. I let six, seven, eight bucks walk this year. And it's because I'm particular, and that's fine. But for someone that doesn't shoot a lot of deer, like, why people, you see them on forums. You never see it in person. You never see it in person. It's just on social media is when you really see that.
So I have a follow-up question for that. So do you think that is something that the hunting industry kind of like the big names, you know, like the corporations are driving, or do you think that that's like a social media driven change in kind of the environment of hunting?
It's definitely advertising fed into. So to kind of answer a two-prong answer based still on the first one, you will never grow 160, 180, 200 inch buck by buying a $20 bag of feed, you know, and putting it behind your house. Like, it's just not how that works. Like, you know, deer protein is like the silliest thing. You know, the real answer is food plots and natural habitat of the deer. Like, right. Like, that's the only way it really works and sustainable. So all that stuff is like gimmicky. And then they seem to make it seem normal that people shoot 160, like booners and above, right? 160s and above. And I can tell you, I've been hunting for over, let's see, it is about 22 years now. My current biggest buck is in PA, archery is 147. And that's, in my opinion, a massive deer. Especially for PA. I shot it in archery, and it's a 10-pointer. It's beautiful. I have two 10-pointers mounted that are my two largest ones. The one's 135, and the other one's 47. And you can't – and you look at it, certain states just grow monster deer. I personally – do not know someone in PA that has shot bigger than 150-inch deer. In deer camps, I just never seen 150-inch and above get killed in, you know, rifle season. So I think that normalizing booner-style deer is a downfall, that every deer is a trophy, buck or doe. And I think that gets lost. And unless you're in a position where you shoot a lot of deer, don't be particular. Just harvest your buck and harvest your doe and enjoy it. I don't get what people are putting against themselves, right? Why are they putting themselves on a pedestal? That, Ed, can you imagine if I called you and said, oh, I shot a deer, but I was like, you know, it wasn't my biggest. It was, you know, it wasn't my greatest, but, you know, it's just like, no, you talk about the story and the experience of that, you know, what beautiful thing hunting is.
Oh yeah, and I think it has a lot to do with social media, you know.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, you look on social media; it's always like a big buck down, or, you know, it's always the BBD hashtag BBD. You know, big buck down. It's like, why can't it just be a buck down? Like, why does it have to be a big buck? Like, it could be a big buck in your mind. Like you say, like Jonathan, you said how you never saw it in person. There was a past weekend when I was up at my camp, I went to the bar and they were, weighing in and measuring bucks at this bar. And I was at the bar and I was like, hey, you have any, you know, nice buck come in, all that kind of stuff. And because I had some really nice ones on camera up there, and I just wanted to know if they came in at all, you know, selfishly, I wanted to know if they came in. So the bartender's like, no, nothing to be proud of. I'm like,
that's terrible.
I was like, are you shitting me right now? Like, what? Like, she said there was a 7-point that came in with an 18-inch spread, which I was like, that's a nice spread on a buck. Like, if they shot, they're very happy with it. And then they said a 5-point came in that would have beaten this 7 point if it had one more point on it. And I was like, those seem like very nice buck.
Like, listen, I almost shot a 5-pointer this year because the rack on the one side was deformed and it was a claw.
Oh, that would have been so cool. Yes.
And I was like, it was literally a split second decision. And I said, you know what? That is such a cool rack. I would love to see what he is next year. So I waited because if that claw, if he still has that deformity, it was literally like a claw and it was thick and it was mutant. Something happened. It got damaged or something happened during its growth process. And it was a legal buck. And I could tell you what, I was borderline drawing my bow, you know, and I was going back and forth, but very cool. So I don't hate again on 5-pointers. I don't hate on any of that. And something that's pretty cool, what I used to, when I first started advertising for Heated Hunts, you can go on our YouTube and you'll see this, that I actually took pictures from just literally with different staff and stuff that Ed's been doing. We were on trail cameras of, you know, deer in their natural habitat of the product working. It's not a manipulated advertisement like you see, right? When there's like deer in a pen and they push towards a product, right? It's literally in the trail camera, you know, 6 in the afternoon, 3 in the afternoon, whatever. And it'll be a fawn walking up to the product. It'll be 2 or 3 doe walking up to the product. It'll be a 6-pointer, an 8-pointer. And then, yeah, you know, we obviously show that mature deer it also attracts. But the whole idea is that I wanted to show the spectrum, right? The spectrum of, you know, infants to mature, and then also show people harvesting that. So on our website, on our social media, in our website, we post pictures of people, you know, shooting, you know, small trophies and large trophies because they're all trophies. And I always just try to distill that in everybody I talk to and everywhere I go when we get in conversations about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think that is missing in the hunting realm now is like every deer you harvest is a trophy because you put the work in to get that deer. Like, I mean, I saw something the other day that was like, you know, rifle hunters won't know as much about deer that an archery hunter can learn in a matter of a year. I mean, it can be true, but like, it's still, they're still putting that work in with the rifle to get a deer, you know, whether it be drives, whether it be, you know, just going out, taking the gun for a walk or anything like that. Like it's, you're still putting the work in and we all get to enjoy this thing that we get to do.
The other thing that's really funny is I'll hit you up with this. You shoot a deer, you post a picture, and they're like, and they get all tactical. It's very weird. did you shoot a, what kind of bow was it? What kind of crossbow was it? What kind of broadhead was it? You know, what kind of arrow fletchings did you have? And you're like, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? I speared this deer first off. No. But that's so bizarre to me, just because I feel like I'm an old timer because I've been hunting for over 20 years. So coming from, no one used to ask those questions. Those questions really started on social media.
Yeah, because, I mean, you look at all the products out there now, like all the different broadheads, all the different arrows. You know, you customize your arrow. You can do different fletchings. You can do, I mean, it's endless, really, what you could do. And that's, I think that's why that conversation comes about, like, people want us to talk about gear. Like I'll talk about some gear, but it's like, I'm not a gear junkie. Like I'm not like going to like talk about like all this different gear that I have that I go out with all the time. Like it's just like, I can't put my hand around like, oh, I use this type of broadhead or this type of arrow all the time. Or I use this weight or this is the grainage. And I just can't, like, it's just with my weapon. It's like, I just know it's a 270. I know I'm using a Bear blackout bow.
So put it that way, right? So put it that way, and that's a really good example. So 270, and every 2 to 3 years they come out with an ammo that's maybe slightly better than it was 2 to 3 years ago.
Yep.
So it's like you still just shot with a 270. That's great. You know, why not? Did you have the expandable broad bullets on that, or did you have just the expandable one?
Like, did it mushroom?
Yeah.
How about that mushroom? What was a mushroom like?
Yeah.
Hell, I use like,
it makes people laugh, and then they're like, "Oh, when you shot your deer last year, what was the moon cycle?" And I'm like, "I'm gonna have something." I'm like,
"Oh, don't even get started on this."
Are you serious right now? Like, because I think if you're really into hunting, you probably put over 20 hunts, I would think, in a year. You know, mm-hmm. I would think if you're pretty serious about it. Because you have a lot of those guys that hit opening day in PA, right? Opening day rifle, maybe the day after, and they have just two hunts a year. But if you're pretty serious, you know, I think like the 20 hunt mark is like, you know, really defines a serious hunter. And then I realize once you get over that mark, they start, they usually don't ask those weird questions.
Yeah.
It's always like those gimmicky style people that don't hunt a lot that ask those questions because they're trying to get the result. Because the result's hard.
It is. Yes.
For someone that shot a lot of deer, it's really hard to be good at it. Mm-hmm. And say we all went on the soccer field, right? And Ed would probably kick us all, right? You know, but no, I'm just, it's hard to be good at any sport. And not a lot of people want to put the time in on anything. They expect the result to be there. And that's just where culture is.
Hello and welcome back to Backcountry PA News. My name is Mr. America. Let's get into it. So this first one comes from CBSNews.com. Neighbors upset after man butchers deer at home in front of school. Now, this is a pretty short article. It comes with a little video if you want to check it out. But basically, out in Greensburg, PA, out towards Pittsburgh, there is a man who shot a buck and decided to butcher it at his home. He only has one tree in his yard, however, and it's right in front of a school. So some of his neighbors are upset about this. It's been hanging in front of the tree. It's the only place that he can butcher it. It's 100% legal for him to do this, but some people think that it's inappropriate. One person said, "I got a grandchild just down the street, and I think it would really upset him to see a gutted deer hanging upside down in front yard. My dad and my brothers are hunters, so I have no problem with it," said another. And Lucas Smith, the person who's butchering the deer, said that he feels terrible about doing it in front of the school, but it's where he lives, and there's no other choice. There are no other trees in the yard, so if he does it, he's going to be doing it there. He's not not trying to do it to upset anyone, but it's just kind of the lay of the land. I think, from personal opinion, I think that it's kind of ridiculous to think that it's inappropriate to do that in front of a school. Kids need to learn about life, you know? And I think if as long as it's done respectfully and he's doing everything that he can to do it correctly, you know, I think it's a great learning opportunity for kids that this is a way of life and some people enjoy hunting and there's nothing wrong with that. And to the person that thinks that it would upset their grandson to see or grandchild to see the animal hanging up in the front yard, I think that's a little ridiculous because what about all of the deer that we see splattered along the side of the road that aren't even being utilized whatsoever? You know, how is that appropriate for children? I think this is muddy waters that you get into, but I think at the end of the day, people need to calm themselves. I'm reporting on it, so that's kind of hypocritical for me to say that I don't even think that it should be news, but here we are. We're talking about it. If you think differently or you think that this isn't appropriate or that something else should be done, let me know. This next one comes from PenLive.com. One buck, two sets of antlers, deer hunter's harvest brings rare surprise. Mike Lewis recently had the type of hunt that, well, you just don't see every day. And that's because while bow hunting in Missouri, he shot one buck and came up with two racks of antler. That's one buck, two sets of antlers, deer hunter's harvest brings rare surprise. This is a really short one, really sweet, but a really cool situation. So it appears, no, not that the deer had two sets of antlers growing, but rather that he harvested one buck and it still had the antlers and skull of another buck locked in its own. I think that it's really fascinating for a multitude of reasons. There's lots of questions that pop up for me that are still a little unclear. But my question would be, what happened to the other deer? Because if you're locked up in a scrap, right, and the antlers and the skull get stuck in that rack for long enough that the animal died, and then the other buck survived to go on and get harvested, was he running around with like a carcass on his head? I think it's very, very interesting. They do have some pictures on the Missouri Department of Conservation's Facebook page, and they have a link within the article that you can go and check out. I think that this particular story is really fascinating. And this next one comes from OutdoorLife.com. A 65-year-old Michigan man says he poached three hawks to spite his utility company. Arthur Anderson faces 6 months probation and thousands of dollars in fines after pleading no contest to the poaching charges a couple weeks ago. So this man is from Macomb Township, Michigan. He wanted to have some trees removed from his property, and he hired a utility company to come in and do it. When they got there, they found a nest of Cooper's hawks inside the tree, up in the limbs. So they said, no way, man, we're not going to disturb these animals. They're protected, so we're not going to remove these trees from your property because we're not going to do that. Apparently, he went back into his house, grabbed a shotgun, and shot the nest 3 to 4 times, and they said maybe even 5 or more times. 3 dead hawks then fell to the ground. The Department of Natural Resources received an anonymous tip about this soon afterwards, and conservation officers went to his home. While they were interviewing him, he first said that he was trying to shoot squirrels, but then eventually caved and told them that he shot the hawks because he was mad at the utility company. He now owes the state $4,500 in reimbursement costs, that's $1,500 per bird, along with $475 in additional fines. He also faces 6 months probation. He pleaded no contest to the poaching charges in district court on December 9th. The shotgun that he used to shoot the hawks was also confiscated by the DNR. Cooper's hawks are federally protected under the U.S. Migratory Bird Act, and it is illegal to shoot them in all 50 states. They are listed as a species of special concern in Michigan until recently, and their total population is estimated at 20,000 birds in Michigan. Often confused with sharp-shinned hawks, they are known as bird hawks because they prey on other smaller birds. They often wait and lurk on songbirds that come into bird feeders in suburbia and in backyards. This is a really sad story. Just a reminder to remember to be safe out there. When you have moments where you get frustrated, you know, think rationally. And it's important to keep a cool head when you're out in the woods, even when you're on your home, because just because it's on your property doesn't mean that it is your property, especially when it comes to animals. They're a natural resource, and they should be treated fairly and with respect, and they shouldn't just be something that you abuse just because you don't get your way. Sorry to bring you down on such a low note there. I didn't really think that it was going to get that serious here at the end of the show, but that's the way that it goes sometimes. It's the news, and sometimes the news isn't always what you want to hear. But as a reminder, I want you all to enjoy your holiday. We're coming up on Christmas. It's going to be a really great time. For those of you that don't celebrate Christmas, enjoy your holiday if you get time off. Hopefully you'll get a floating holiday. Christmas is on Sunday this year. But thank you so much for listening to this episode of Backcountry PA News. Remember to stay safe and keep your tradition.
So that's social media, right? Like you, like it's always, here's the result. Mm-hmm. Here's what I got. Here's what I did. Here's what I accomplished. And it's never like, oh yeah, you want to see, like, come take a walk in my shoes of how much work I put in to accomplish this. Like people don't see that behind the scenes stuff. And it's so like, and that's why I think too, it makes like a, you know, just like even if you get a doe, right? Mm-hmm. Or you're getting like a smaller buck and you post that, like people aren't going to know. First of all, if you post it and you got like a 7-paragraph caption on it, no one's going to read. But right, like it's not, you can't be like, oh yeah, here's the crazy story behind this. They just see, there's the picture.
Well, here's the thing is, some of the hunting TV shows are also misleading. So what's like not for real? This is like not a real thing that happens, because like these ranches, some of these ranches, low fence, high fence, no fence, they still control the population of the animals they harvest just as much as a cattle cow farmer, just as much as a milk farmer, right? That they're farming. That's what they're doing. They're farming animals, and they're doing it no different other than you get to shoot at them. You know, you know, it just be simple. So some of these shows are literally so ridiculous, and they put someone in a big box stand, and let's just say they give them a 270, and they're like, all right, sir, you be ready, because at 7:04, 60 deer are going to enter this alfalfa field. Now, we're going to film it just from the left. So you got to pick one of them from the left so it doesn't look like the whole herd's coming in. Like, people don't realize this is some of the TV editing that is happening.
Yeah.
And they expect when they go in a stand that their result is going to be instant. And then they're like, well, what am I doing wrong? You know, my result wasn't instant. But I'm a big fan of, obviously, of hunting products. And I'm a big fan of designing hunting products. And what I like to tell people, and they're like, Ed and I will be at shows, and they'll be like, is this going to get me the big one? And I'm like, well, first off, it's not going to make you a better shot. I can't help you with that. You got to put your own time in. What I can tell you is this product, you know, will make you see more deer. Mm-hmm. And if you literally hunt in the worst hunting conditions ever, and there's no deer for like one deer per 1 square mile, something ridiculous, it's probably not going to work too well for you. So you still have to do some of your scouting, do everything else. But what it will do is put the opportunity in front of you more. You know, and that's the story I like to tell. And then the other story is that we have so many different scents that you can use a more buck aggressive scent, you know, a general curiosity scent that you won't spook any deer. And when we have this conversation at shows, we get to meet with these customers, is that do you just want to see more deer? Use a curiosity scent. Basically, you know, but a lot of people don't know that, right? They also don't know in PA, like, don't use doe estrus before like Halloween or November 1st, right? And they're like, we see people like posting trail cam footage, or they'll send us an email, and it's sad, but it's comical. Like, hey, I just put your high octane, your premium doe estrus out in the middle of July, and no deer came up to it yet. And I'm like, oh my Lord, like, wow. So Ed and I, we built this scent playbook that labels like when to use which type of scent when. So, like, I felt like hunting education, hunting guides, like how to make a mock scrape. All these things we realize is that I know them. And sometimes because I've been doing it for so long, I feel like I assume some people already know some of those activities.
Right.
And then, you know, you get better at it. And I'm like, you know what? We're going to simplify the messaging. If you want this kind of result, here's the kind of approach you take. If you're willing to put an extremely aggressive buck scent out and not care if you scare off every 6-pointer in a square mile, you can use this type of stuff. And we felt like that was very helpful to hunters. For the industry, right? It's like that weird, and I realized it's not that real educational and honest approach to products. I find is very unique.
A good segue.
Absolutely. I mean, that was a perfect segue there, Jonathan. So I got the dispenser here.
Oh, cool.
So let's talk about the dispenser, how you came up with that, and just dive into it. Honestly, let's talk about the new dispenser and what it involves.
Yeah, I'll do the flyover first. So imagine six, probably 7 years ago now. It was one of those archery seasons where it's so cold, and literally I'm out. I'm in my stand like 20 minutes. I'm freezing. And I'm looking, I can see the sun come up. Well, I wasn't out for 20 minutes. The sun's been out for about 20 minutes. And then all of a sudden in the morning, I look and I can see my wick is literally like frosted. And I'm like, wow, that scent's not going to work very well.
Yeah.
So I hunted the rest of the day, literally went back to my shop, and just one of those guys that just go with tools, go with building stuff, you know, general understanding of electronics, everything like that. Went ahead and created a simple wire to a D-cell battery to a, what looks like a coat hanger. And I got the same fabric. I cut a slit in it. I put the heater inside the wicks. And I said, there is no product on the hunting market that heats wicks. Absolutely none. And I found that fascinating when I thought about it, because I was like Googling it. And I'm like, there has to be a solution out in the industry that allows a hunter to heat honey wicks. Because I know, just from like general physics, is that if I was going to heat, say, 2 ounces of a liquid or an ounce of liquid, that requires like a lot of energy, right? You would think to like boil, like make a cup of coffee, right? Like, think about the apparatus that makes a cup of coffee and then try to scale that down. Right? So none of that works. It has to be just heating the wicks. So I made this homemade device, and the next day, or that afternoon, actually, I went out with it, and I had deer reacting to it, and I couldn't believe it. So it went on throughout the season. I shot a nice buck, and I told my wife, I'm like, listen, we've been talking about building our dream house, like, you know, next year or so. Do you want me to kind of put that on hold and risk it a little bit and just run with an idea that could potentially allow us to get a totally different dream house, you know, in a few years if this company works? And I wasn't lucky enough to be from one of those family where you can just go ask for a loan all that situation. And some of those people are blessed, and that's great.
Yes.
My kids are going to be blessed like that because I took that risk.
Right.
You know, so, and what ended up happening was that my wife's like, honey, I'm all on board with you. I'm going to help you grow this company. So we've been doing it, and we've been kicking butt. It went from this makeshift idea to work with patent lawyers, to engineers. And it was just I brought the philosophy and initial technology and said, this is what I made. Mm-hmm. How do we make this in a product that we can build? And my whole mindset was, we got to build something really cool that'll last long and durable for under $50. Mm-hmm. Because I was like, we could build this out of machined aluminum. It'll last 100 years, the most advanced technology. You could turn it on with your phone, right? Any of that stuff. Yeah, it's going to be $200. And I said, you know what? And I really don't care about any of this stuff other than it's got to be made in America. Mm-hmm. And this is back when I started Googling companies. There was not a single hunting product manufacturer other than duck, turkey calls that actually had American made products. And I was like, that is insane. That is the craziest thing about the hunting industry. We are, hunters supporting veterans. Majority of us, you know, all have that same view as we're in this sport together. I'm like, how is that not a huge attribute that when you go to the store, you're looking at tags, you know, every piece of hunting clothing is made overseas. Mm-hmm. Boots. I'm like, wow. So I said, we got to make it work. And wow, that was a headache. I realized I could not source 100% American made at all. Yeah. It was impossible. A small switch manufacturer, we'll just say it generally, because of course it doesn't exist in the United States anymore. They just don't. And now you may find one that's like a door switch for a house that might be USA made. But like microelectronics, there was not one that could be identified as a possible, even remotely, that would supply a product for this. So that was like kind of also additionally disheartening. And then it was like, okay, well, what can I get? You know, what are the opportunities for products in the United States? What are the labor is definitely in the United States. What do I have to buy overseas? And then kind of keep it short, it ended up being the plastics, the labels, the glues, the silicones, all the labor, the felts, you know, small little trinkets end up being. So it was ended up being like 90% American made and sourced, which I don't think enough people actually focus on, is actually sourcing and manufacturing.
Right.
And so that's just a different story, because I'm very passionate about it, if you can't tell.
Yeah.
And I think it's very cool, because going to these ATA and other shows, where you meet other owners, manufacturers, they're like, Jonathan, how'd you do that? Like, yeah. How'd you actually, like, we just built everything in China. It comes over on a ship. It takes 6 months to get here. And I'm like, that's pretty terrible. Said, I don't know how to do that because I never educated myself on that. I only educated myself on how to do it in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm competitive with you guys. So why are you guys doing it that way? And they're like, right. Can you show us how you did it? And I was like, oh, that's a weird conversation to have.
No.
So anyway, that story and dance of prototyping,
mm-hmm.
Design was very interesting. Being very strong in my roots of American made, American sourced, mm-hmm. still holds true to this day, 6 years later.
Yeah.
Even with our new version, you get what you the biggest challenge when you're building something is what you think you get versus what you get isn't exactly what happens in real life. Just right. like if you know, and a lot of people don't realize that my version one is about 90% what I wanted. And there was a few small things that I was told was going to be different. And when all the stuff shows up and you're like, well, this is what I got. You got to figure it out.
Yeah.
Like you can, we didn't have the funding to say, we're going to go tweak this or do that. So we rolled with it. But version two that we launched this year, it was a huge success.
Mm-hmm.
The product is simply this. So between version one, version two, what the product does, just for all the listeners, you take a battery, you take a switch, controlled electronics, and it has silicone wires that come out of the controlled electronics into a heater, and the mm-hmm. heater is inside of the wicks. So you heat up two wicks like a sandwich so that your heat's getting the most efficient use of it. And people are like, oh, I'm sure the deer smell the difference between, you know, the scent that's a temperature of a live deer or not. And it simply put is this. If you heat up any scent, like if you guys in there or at my place, we lit a candle or we mm-hmm. had a candle across the room, you wouldn't even know the candle was there until you lit it. And then there's even things like candle warmers, right? So mm-hmm. as soon as you actually increase that temperature of anything, and it doesn't have to be a deer scent, it smells stronger, it travels more, and it goes further.
Yeah.
And what we realized is that when we started messing around with deer urines, apples, sweet corn, all these different scents we offer, is mm-hmm. the reaction is literally, if you can imagine setting up a trail camera or two trail cameras very close to each other and putting out just say corn on a branch and corn in the dispenser and heating it up and saying, wow, why are like 90% of the animals going to the scent dispenser? And not even remotely checking out another corn pile, mm-hmm. right? Because it smells like that right next to it. And so those kind of tests is what we did. And we could have did any temperature, right? That yeah. we could have done with the batteries. We could have did 150. We could have did 50 degrees, you know. So throughout testing, we dialed it in. And the results are phenomenal. So we've been doing it, I mean, literally – I have thousands of emails of customers and comments on social media, people sending us pictures, holding the animal. Yeah. I have so many stories of people saying they were looking in right field and all of a sudden they look to the left at the dispenser and there's a deer staring at it. You know, I have so many stories of people saying, I love your product. I can't stand it when small bucks knock it off the branch and I have to get down and hang it back up. I'm like, you know, that's like the best insult complaint you can possibly yeah. say is deer are coming in reacting to the product yeah. and knocking it over. But we took all that feedback, good, positive, the good, bad, and the ugly,
mm-hmm.
and then we put it into our version two. So the yeah. version two to its core does the same thing, battery, controlled electronics, and a heater. But what we did is a better battery. We now have a large rechargeable lithium ion battery with a simple charge port. Mm-hmm. Controls are more robust. We plot the whole inside with silicone. So people can leave it outside and it won't break. The heater's bigger. The wicks are bigger. The way that we contain and hold the actual wicks together is more efficient. How it comes in and out of the container is more efficient and user-friendly. The top has an adaptable hook. So that way if small deer actually hit the dispenser or do something like that, it won't fall off if it's in high winds. The adaptable hook lets you do from like a twig to like, you know, a bigger size branch. So it's a really good product. Really proud of our version 2 dispenser.
Yeah. So like when I'm doing shows and I actually have one of the dispensers turned on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people like, does it really get that warm? Then I open it up and let them wrap their hand around it. And they're like, wow, I can't believe how warm that dispenser, you know, how warm that yeah. is.
Wow.
And
yeah, I'm excited. I'm going to be going out tomorrow and I'm going to be taking that with me.
Can you yeah. guys like sell these hooks? Like these are awesome. Like this is it's like it makes me think of like a really robust twist tie. Like just like you could use this for anything.
Yeah.
You could tie up your bread.
The options are endless.
Tie up your bread.
Tie up, that's my number one, you know.
Tie up your bread.
Just, yeah. So
you could securely tie up your bread better than you securely tied it up ever before.
It's almost lockable.
No, but I get where you're going though. That adaptable hook, it's very robust. It's basically mm-hmm. a few strands of metal, you know, wound together with a few layers of silicone. So it really gives it that it sticks and it stays, which yep. is something that if you had the opportunity of doing like a twist tie approach, or so it really stays on a branch. Mm-hmm. And if it's a really large branch, you can actually make it so it's a big looping hook, so it's like half arc on it.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
We had a plastic because this is one of those things I was telling you to go through engineering is you don't get what you get necessarily is how people explain it. So this engineer was like, this hook is unbreakable. And I'm like, So if I throw it off like out my window in my office, it won't break. He's like, absolutely not. Well, when you get it, and if I threw that original version of my dispenser out the window, it would definitely break the hook. So like, it comes down to like an engineer says use like an eighth inch bolt, and you're like, I'm going to use a quarter inch bolt just because you're an engineer, and you don't consider like somebody putting a scent dispenser in their backpack mm-hmm. and throwing the backpack in the back of their truck. Like, I just want something that didn't break. So right. if I have an adaptable hook now, it doesn't break, and then. The other funny thing is, like, the actual frame of the dispenser with those arcs and stuff we have on it, mm-hmm. that stops the product from breaking, too. Like, we've had customers that are like, so I was driving my quad, and it fell out the quad, and I ran it over, and it still works. So I'm just writing an email to say thank you for building a good product. And I'm like,
yeah,
I know. Cool email to receive, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I know. I appreciate that, because there's a few times I've thrown my backpack in the back of the car, and I'm thinking, okay, what did I put in there again? What's broken? Yeah. What's not broken? Like crap.
Yep. Right. And it's funny to me because I tell people, like the version one, I was like, treat it like a set of binoculars.
Mm-hmm.
Like you wouldn't launch your binoculars in the back of your truck. Like if you treat it the same way, it wouldn't break. Then I got it. Everyone's in a rush or they're trying to take advantage of just getting in the woods or getting out of the woods and they got family or places to go. And I'm like, we got to just make a better hook. It's on us. Because we made a better hook. You know, we try to tell people to be careful with this. So, and I'm sure after another year or so or two, and we get feedback on our version two, and then I don't know what they say, like we want micro dispensers or something like that, right? You know, that'd be like the roadmap of the product, like your product life cycle. You think of an idea, you build it, see how it works. We sold tens of thousands of these,
mm-hmm.
Tens of thousands of happy customers. I also learned in business, you cannot make everyone happy no matter what.
That's very true. Yes.
And it's sad because you're like, man, I'm sitting here putting my sweat, heart, and tears into this thing. Mm-hmm. And you're like saying the product's terrible because the product you got, the label was discolored on the corner. Like, how about we just send you a new label or I send you a new product? Like, it's really not like a deal breaker over something so minuscule. And some people are that particular. They're like, you had one chance for an impression.
Yeah.
And because the post office delivered my product a day late, I'm leaving you a negative review. And it's like, it's painful to respond back to those emails. You say something like, we manufacture hunting products. We are not the carrier service of those hunting products. Why don't you call your local postman and yell at them? Like, what do you say to them? Stuff like people are just like on the hunting industry. We talk about all these crazy things on social media. Some of these people have unrealistic expectations.
Absolutely,
They will go and hang you out to dry because they ordered on a Thursday and it didn't show up on Saturday. But then like, you show them like a script, you reply back and say, I'm sorry, ma'am or sir, right? Your product order came in at 10. You actually hit our noon shipping that day, and it left our facility. What else do you want us to do? We didn't tell you it was going to be there on Saturday, but within 2 hours of you ordering, because of the time of the day, we ship every day, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's usually a noon and five. And if you put an order in between the time range, that's what we try to do. We try to get everything out same day or by the next morning. Yep. And then you have to make a decision when those times come up. That's what's ready. Send it. Mm-hmm. You know, people are like, well, how come I didn't go out? You know, you start telling them too much information. But it's no. We got our 40 orders by noon, and that's what went out that day. Yep. And then the next 30 or whatever went out, and then we were good. But sometimes it spills over a day. But we're pretty good. We never spill over more than about a day. And normally, I would say normal business is about a half day just because of the timing.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, because, like, if it comes in at 3, very rarely you're going to get that out by 5. It's just very tight, you know. But it just came in after lunch. It usually hits it. So we're doing a pretty good system.
So you don't only have the scent dispenser. You have scents that go into it as well.
Yeah, and absolutely.
The one I got was high octane. Do you want to go over the scents that you have and when to use them, when not to use them, all that kind of stuff? Just break it down one by one and just go through it like that.
Here's what I'll do. I want to make sure I work Ed into this podcast with this and everything. So what I want to do is I'm going to break it down into general categories and let Ed talk about them a little bit.
Yeah, that works.
Simply put, the highest category is natural scents and synthetic scents.
Mm-hmm.
So natural would be from a deer, doe, or buck, and Ed will talk about that. And synthetic, we have synthetic doe or buck, but we also have synthetic, like, food attractants. That would be like your apple, acorn. We also have bear attractants that are very interesting, and then cover scents and scent eliminators. Mm-hmm. So it's really that old saying, the whole nine yards. And real cool tidbit. I love that saying, the whole nine yards. And it wasn't from a few years ago, because I was like, why is it the whole 10 yards? Do you guys have any idea why it's called the whole nine yards?
I actually do know this. Oh, the story about that. Gun.
All right, you don't say it. You hold it.
I'll hold it.
My guess would be is because
you never guess. It's so random.
Yeah,
that's why I love this saying, and I love saying it all the time.
I feel like I know, but I don't think I do. So.
All right, let me see. If go ahead, give us your story. Okay.
This is the story that I know of it.
All right,
it's war related. Fighter pilots.
Yep.
With the belts when they have they're shooting out of the planes.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
9 yards long. And they give them the whole 9 yards.
They're 40 or 50 caliber machine gun on the fighter pilots. And they would be like, I gave that, you know, whatever, let's say Japanese fighter pilot. Whole 9 yards, right? And took them out. That is literally what changed. Because think about it. What is there? Like less than 10,000, less than 50,000 fighter pilots in World War II? You know, whatever that number is, you know what I mean? That saying carried to like 50 years later, 60 years and change later, that people use it in common terms. Like, that's amazing to me. And it always struck me funny because it was, you would think 10 yards because of football. Right.
Yeah.
And that's what a lot of people think. And there's 9 yards, and you say it all the time. But Ed, we just had some fun. Ed, break down some of the scents and what heated hunts does.
So, like the buck and doe tell is a synthetic scent. That's a curiosity scent. You know, it doesn't spook the deer. You know, it piques their curiosity. That's why it's a curiosity scent. Now, like your buck, your brute buck and your buck musk is, we have a synthetic and a natural in that. And that's a stronger, like the buck musk is really potent.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that.
Oh my God. The buck musk will literally make you do like the eyebrow, like the rock. It is exactly what you would expect. It is the grotesque, extreme aroma of a buck that's in, you know, full rut. And what Ed's getting to is like the different, like brute buck is more of a non-rutted buck, you know, tarsal gland and urine. When you pair glands with urine, it works really well. Yeah. And then on the buck musk, you know, a rutted buck smells very different than a non-rutted buck.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have more of your pre-rut versus your, you know, your rut, you know, style aromas. And then we make both of those in natural and synthetic. And one of my favorite things at the shows is that you get these like guys that are like, I can smell, you know, this and that and tell you what it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you'll say, all right, you tell me which one's natural, which one's synthetic, right?
Yeah.
And same scent. And you open the bottle. I'll open them. I'll turn around and collect this as they smell. You know, like literally 9 out of 10 times, the guys just like, they're like, I can't tell a difference. Mm-hmm. Or they're like, I'm just going to blatantly guess because I can't tell. That's how accurate our synthetic scents are.
Yeah.
And there's pros and cons. And that's what a lot of people don't get to. Is like, well, why would I use a natural instead of the synthetic? And I explain it this way. So say you're making a mock scrape or even just using it in the dispenser.
Mm-hmm.
You use a organic scent. That scent, from when you start using it to within a few hours, it starts breaking down and changing in aroma. Because that's the life cycle of urine exposed to oxygen. It breaks down. It's organic, and it breaks down very quickly. So if a deer mm-hmm. urinates on the ground, it does not smell like deer urine forever. It dissipates into the ground and it's gone, right? It breaks down. The cool thing is, if any of you guys are wearing cologne or, you know, your lady wears perfume, mm-hmm. whenever they spray that bottle, it's always the same and that aroma does not change, regardless if it's exposed to oxygen or not, for the most part, right? Mm-hmm. So imagine having a deer urine that's kind of like a perfume or a cologne, that it's in a state that doesn't break down is the point. Yeah. So if you made a mock scrape and you sprayed some organic and then it broke down, and that would be a natural way of representing a mock scrape. Mm-hmm. But if you sprayed the synthetic, it would always make the scrape smell more fresh because it doesn't break down.
Okay.
And that, so I'm like, what people don't realize is that you could put synthetic into the dispenser and never really have anything to worry about and just go, like these novice hunts. I said, there's a huge advantage of that. When you put synthetic versus natural side by side in their pure state, natural will ruin every time, but it has that breakdown cycle.
Yeah.
So there's this, it's one of those things of, you know, what vehicle do you want to drive? Do you want a four-wheel drive truck or do you want a four-wheel drive car? There's just different vehicles depending on what you're doing. And they both work fine. It's just understanding that, you know, mechanism, how they work.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, especially when at the show and then you let people smell the synthetic, they're like, I can't believe how real that smells. Yeah. It doesn't smell. I smelled many other people's. It smells like, you know, ammonia. It doesn't smell.
Ammonia, vinegar, we get a lot of people say like.
Yeah, a lot of vinegar, yeah.
Yeah, vinegary and aroma smells. I'm like, you actually smell our synthetics. It's legit. We probably have more time into our scent engineering.
Yeah.
Because we built a heated scent dispenser, and that took like a huge effort, you know, like 18 months to build it. But when it was built, there wasn't really a lot of tweaking to do. Versus these scent aromas, you know, you're tweaking. Like our formulation of Acorn in 2016 is not our formulation of Acorn that we do today.
Right.
You know, we're always advancing our synthetic and our scents in general.
Mm-hmm.
Every year we're putting in, I don't know, 50 to 100 hours of just tweaking formulations that people love. But if you're not pushing to make it better, what are you doing as a company owner?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
That's the way I look at it. Like, I'm not sitting in my recliner. We're trying to push stuff in the company to make it grow. Make stuff that's better.
Yeah. So then what's next after the buck ones? What's the next sense you got? Let's keep going down the list here.
Sure. So the whole breakdown of, well, we had curiosity and then the buck sense, you know, your early season aggressive, different combinations, obviously your doe estrus. Some people may think it's funny, but we sell multiple grades of doe estrus. And you're like, wait, why would you do that? Well, there's a price point for every customer.
Mm-hmm.
And some people look for quality and value, and other people look for more expensive premium results. So we have a very, what we consider high-end doe estrus, which is our premium doe estrus, which is called high octane. And we work with multiple deer farms. And what we do, we're going to keep it simple for this show, is if you could imagine if you had a deer farm and you had 10 5-gallon containers of doe estrus, and I said, give me a sample of each one of those. And I work with multiple deer farms, and I said, give me your sample of all those. And then within 1 week, I'm going to buy, you know, a bunch of them off you if they're good. Mm-hmm. So they'll wait, and I'll send them to a lab, and the lab will tell me which ones are the most potent of all the samples that I received. And I will buy the most potent ones. And what it is actually the grading of doe estrus in the actual urine itself.
Oh.
So it's lab certified to have an extreme concentration of doe estrus.
Yeah.
You would be surprised how much doe estrus deer farms are advertising as doe estrus that has almost zero doe estrus in it.
Oh, and I'm sure.
And only has doe urine. And it doesn't smell any different. I don't care what these people say. They're like, oh, I could smell the estrus in this. I'm like, that's deer pee, because as a human, we cannot smell the sexual gland attractiveness of a doe.
Yeah.
Because we are not a buck, but I'm glad you think you could smell that.
Right. So but, the best time frame for the high octane.
So what we do is that a lot of deer farms that we work with, they bring in, it's different than what it used to be back in the day. In the day, they would have to wait until the month of October and scramble to bottle it as fast as they can.
Right.
Now, think about how, let's just say cattle breed year round, right? Mm-hmm. So what they'll do is they treat it like a farm, and they bring these does into heat multiple times a year. And the idea is, you can only do it so many times a year, but when you do it, collect it at its peak. Mm-hmm. And deer urine in general, I mean, there's differences of opinion here. The things that break down deer urine is oxygen and light for the most part. So that's why we use dark bottles. You know, we use a one valve mister. So when you want to use the urine, it limits the oxygen. And just by doing those two things, I'm comfortably saying if you generally keep it, temperature cool, obviously if you're baking it, so it's in the sun, it's going to spoil. So for natural, comfortably, a 6 months to a year, it will stay very fresh.
Okay.
If you do it that way. And so we get it a few times a year. So it's basically, some people are like, I'm waiting for October 10th to buy it off of you, so it's your most pure stuff. And I'm like, but we bottled October 1st, buddy.
Yeah.
And what came from the deer farm was the week before that. So what I try to do is as soon as we get it from the deer farm, we bottle it. Like, it doesn't sit.
Okay.
And so that's something we do, and we do have the proper storage in our facility. So anyone ever buys anything off us. You're never getting anything that's old. We do turnover. And a lot of things that we'll do. So say our inventory, we had 500 bottles left over just from managing everything. We'll donate it to different veteran organizations that take hunters out and stuff like that.
That's cool.
Because using stuff is better than using nothing.
Yeah.
And that's how we approach it. But our premium doe estrus, real high end stuff. We also have what we call non-lab tested doe estrus. It comes from one particular farm that consistently puts out good product. It's our number one producer of our high octane. We use that and you don't know what you get, but it's assumed to be doe estrus just like anybody else in the industry. Mm-hmm. So it's like $4 or $5 less per bottle. And then we also make a synthetic version of it. So that way states that require it, novice hunters that like the balance of that, traditional stays fresh smell versus the organic. I would say high octane or synthetic or high. Most people that buy our doe estrus are buying more than one bottle. They definitely want to try our premium, and they definitely want to try what else we have.
Well, you have cover sense too. We'll go over those quick, and then we'll get to the last one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sure. So just break down the cover sense. One is that you have two things that to consider in scent industry for cover scent. Yeah. One is actually if you have an aroma on you that you want to remove. So so you're scent elimination, and right. It's more like an encapsulation elimination. There's a bunch of gimmicks out on the industry, but mm-hmm. there's about three lab formulations that exist that everyone sells in different ways. And what they do is they pair it with different cover scents. So there's some companies that will pair it with vanilla, some that'll pair it with just like a pine, mm-hmm. and it will actually encapsulate and eliminate. There's no difference from company to company generally on the scent elimination. Yeah. What we do is we have the same scent elimination basically that's out in the industry. We found one that we felt was the strongest, purest form of scent elimination. And then we did a minor formulation that does a minor cover scent with it. So that's how we came up with it. It was just what we felt was the best one that did the elimination. But there's only a handful in the industry. There's only a handful of labs in the country that build that.
Yeah.
So all these companies that say they're building it, what are they building it in their bathtubs and making gin? Right. Yeah. You know, it doesn't work that way.
For they scent elimination. Campers.
Yeah, exactly. So for scent elimination, it literally comes from a lab and it has to. Because you won't get that enzyme breakdown. You can mess with charcoal and do weird things, but lab grade scent elimination encapsulation definitely works. Think about those companies that make skunk remover soap, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like the same idea. That product just finds its way around.
Yeah.
But we're very proud of ours. It's a very competitive price, and we felt like it was the best lab that we identified, and we had a little cover scent to it.
Yeah.
Now our cover scent is where you get real unique. So what our cover scent, you have a lot of ability to do different aromas and stuff with, right? It's not so mm-hmm. much lab encapsulation style stuff.
Right.
And what we have is we have a, I like to call it as, the scent elimination is called Dirt 5X. All our food attractants cover scents are called 5X because they're five times the concentrate.
Okay.
And what I like to do is go to the store, buy the whole competition, and just say, are all my scents better than these guys? Mm-hmm. And then that's how I know I'm offering a better product. And what we do is our cover scent, our concentrate is called Dirt 5X. It literally smells like dirt. It smells like moss. It smells like a hint of cedar, pine. And the whole idea is if you get around a formulation of about a concentration of balance, like think of a tomato sauce. I'm Italian. Is like, that's not balance. It doesn't work. Right? Mm-hmm. If you have too much onion or you have too much garlic, well, you should have put onion in your tomato sauce, but we won't go there.
Yeah.
Nope. But the point of the story is it has to be a balanced way of how the scent smells, right?
Yeah.
You don't want to have your ups and downs in your aroma. So mm-hmm. we have a really balanced dirt, moss, cedar, and pine, and purposely is weaker on the cedar. And when you get to that many levels of smells, it really helps cover your aroma. It doesn't just smell like the woods. Because if I walked in into where you guys are doing your podcast right now with pizza, wings, and like a couple other appetizers, you'd probably only pick up a one or two in a human.
Yeah. Right?
You wouldn't smell everything that's on the plate. Now, a deer having a better capability of smelling would definitely pick up on more. But if you have a balanced multiple aromas and tweaking that aroma for years, the concentration is insane. It literally give you like the eyebrow, like the rock. I have so many stories of people that are like, I just spray it on the inside of my blind, or I'll actually run it in my dispenser, hang it from my stand, and I never get winded. Because think of these guys that are dropping $500, $600 on ozonics and ozone technology. Ozone technology has been around since the 80s. And for people to think it's new, it's crazy.
Yeah.
You know, it's 03. It's nothing special. It's been around forever.
Yep.
But that's one of those weird advertising things that are like brand new, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Heated scent has been around, you know, since like the 60s. People used to use candles and all these different weird things.
Mm-hmm.
But what we did is we developed a product that heats the wicks. That's our story. There's companies out there that vaporize aromas. Simply put, if you guys, you know, hit a one of those like nicotine vapes that smell like apple and you mm-hmm. blow it all, it literally smells for like 3 seconds and then it's gone.
Yep.
And that's why a lot of people will smoke those indoors and in arenas and stuff like that, because you can't even smell it. So by heating the temperature and vaporizing, is quantified, that it actually makes the aroma not hang out.
Got yeah.
It. So that's why we didn't go that route. We realized it was more of that barbecue effect, that yeah. If one person in a neighborhood is cooking, slow cooked ribs or barbecue chicken or, whatever, everybody knows,
you know,
versus someone's frying something or, it's not the same.
Yeah, no, not at all.
Yeah, and then you get mad that you don't get the invite to the barbecue.
I know. A neighbor that's totally killing it on the grill. It's really depressing.
Oh. It is, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, when I do the shows, you won't believe that people seek out the dirt and the high octane from us.
Mm-hmm.
I can, a weekend show, I can sell 200-300 bottles of dirt. People know what it is. They love that scent. They're gonna come there. They'll buy 5-6 bottles at a time because they said we can't get nothing like this. You know,
right?
The same thing for the high octane.
Wow,
that's awesome. What we do for the high octane is very unique. For our whole concentration of our 5X series is very unique. Our cover scent and how we do it, and constant reformulations and tweakings. It's extremely popular. If you're ever at a show and we're there, go check out our products. Mm-hmm. You'll definitely just touch, feel, and see the difference. If you're one of those people that are like, I like what this guy's saying, I want to just do some research, go on our website. Mm-hmm. You can go on social media. There is literally like probably 4,000 dead deer on our Facebook page.
Yeah.
And none of those are paid advertisements. Mm-hmm. They're all people that literally send us pictures.
Yep.
And you can look over 5-6 years of just hundreds and hundreds of dead deer or trail camera footage. We do shoot commercials. So yes, we do shoot commercials for advertising, but there is the raw footage that's available to them.
Ethan, you want to ask the final question here?
Yeah.
We end the podcast?
So here at the podcast, one of the phrases that we always say is keep your tradition. Whatever that happens to be, keep it. I want both of you to answer this. How do you keep your tradition?
Ed, do you want me to go first or do you want to go?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. I think I hear keep your tradition. I'm like, what are the roots? What is the wiring in you of a person, right? Mm-hmm. I think you guys know, you guys kind of figure out loud and clear that I think it's cool to support the country, be an American-made manufacturer. I am literally like one of like zero that doesn't make deer calls or turkey calls that's in the main stage of making American products.
Yeah.
There's a couple other companies that stood up and they're like, we're going to make American-made hats. And that's all they do. But what they do is they don't actually make them. They actually outsource them to a manufacturer that already makes American hats. We actually build our products, within our company. We don't hire a company to build our products. So that's very unique to me. It's very unique to Heated Hunts and what Ed and I do together.
Yeah,
I think that's one of the strongest traditions is having true American values. I check the tags when I shop, and I hope everyone else does too.
Tradition is, with your family, your sons, your daughters, teaching them how to hunt and stuff. I think it fell to the wayside. It's not like it used to be, Going to deer camp was a big deal back 20 years ago. Now it's not so much,
Yeah.
So luckily I don't, I live about 2 hours away from my kids. So my stepdad, if I don't take my kids hunting, he's always taking them hunting. So he's active with them all the time hunting. They go all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big thing for sure.
Yeah.
So where can the listeners go follow you on social media, get a hold of you, all that kind of good stuff, follow along with the journey here and buy some products?
Yeah, I mean, I'll simply put in any search engine, type in Heated Hunts, a bunch of options are going to come up. You can buy our products from eBay, Amazon, our website, all over online. That's what our model is. To keep the costs down, we try to avoid going to stores. We do partner with stores. We love our stores. But the direct-to-consumer from our website is our best avenue where you get the most sales. You get the most interaction because you're dealing directly with us, and we love doing that. If you're a big Amazon user, it's us using Amazon. So your order comes to us. When it goes to Amazon, so you might as well just come to us.
Yeah.
But That's really it, is coming directly to Heat of Hunts. You can get a lot of information on our website. If you choose to buy it on Amazon, it's the same product. It's just the way you're purchasing it is different. And if you have questions, you know, interact with us on social media, interact with us, you know, on our website, sending in emails and things like that. We get a lot of folks that say, hey, you know what? Before I get started, I just want to make sure I understand this correctly. This is the scent I use with that, and this is how I use that. Mm-hmm. Go to our website. You can educate yourself. Kind of what I was telling you about before, the scent playbook of when to use what. Huge. It's by far our most popular piece, is how to use the scents and when. Yep. So go to our website and just check that out. That'll even help you as, even if you don't use our products, right? Just knowing when to use the right products in the hunting industry, you know, that's out there for you on our website.
And don't forget about the children's book.
Yes, I did.
Can we talk about that?
I bought the children's book. It is in my daughter's nursery right now.
That's awesome. So the last thing we'll talk about quick. My wife's amazing. She made this phenomenal hunting book back when there was no hunting books for children. Mm-hmm. I don't even know. There's a few people that popped up after we did it. And it truly tells the beauty of the story of getting someone in a youth into hunting through success. And it has a glossary, it has terms, it has all this base foundation to get someone fired up and into hunting. And we work with professional artists. The artwork is beautiful, colorful, very vibrant. I couldn't think of a way to make the book better. It's super popular and it came out great.
Yeah, it's definitely also a great book.
American printed. American printed, not overseas.
It's definitely a great book. I read it and it made me want to run through a fucking brick wall. So
brick walls here.
Along with coffee.
That was fun.
Well, Jonathan, Ed, thank you for joining us on the podcast. It's been a pleasure and we can't wait to keep working with you guys and go on hunts together sometime.
That's awesome. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.